imagine, or probably you don't have to imagine, those gut-wrenching moments. Those ones that put you on the floor, drop to your knees, agony. That's what's been in my head the last few weeks. Just those moments that you find yourself in, where the anger, you just want to shout, but you try to hold it in. Maybe you don't. Maybe it's the moments where everyone gets out of the car and you stay in the car and you bang on the steering wheel in frustration. Or because everyone's gone, you just scream out because no one can hear you in that moment. Or you beg God to show up. I was trying not to get choked up with Matthew talking about the Barabbas thing, because it just got me thinking, these moments where I realize I am broken. I am not worthy. But he came for us. When I was thinking about this, I was just focused on this idea that we need a God of hope. And so I was looking for books, and I had found a book by a guy named Andrew Root called Evangelism in an Age of Despair. And like many times when you find a book that you think is going to really help you with something, it did nothing for me. Read the whole thing. It was very deep, a little heady. It made some great points, but it didn't really talk about this idea of hope that I was hoping for. But it did a great job of explaining why we live in an age of despair. Because we do. We have people every day living in sorrow and grief. And because of the way our culture has shifted, we don't accept that as a good thing. And so we have hundreds of thousands of millions of people who are suffering from despair, that are lost and alone, who need the words that we have of hope. As Christians, I think we can just as easily fall into this trap and need to be reminded. And so all I could think of was this verse that I had found. Romans 15:13 says, "May the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace as you trust in him, so that you may overflow with hope by the power of the Holy Spirit." I mean, this is one of those verses that it has been stuck with me. I can't get it out of my head. I could do a whole sermon series just breaking down this one alone. And I'm going to keep coming back to this verse in the weeks to come, because honestly, this is one I think everyone should have memorized. This is one that I think when people say, "How can you be in such a good spirit right now?" you point to this right here. But I was thinking, for us to start this series of this God of hope, we really got to know what hope is. And I thank you, Petrina, for taking a very hard passage to read out loud with lots of misunderstandings, and having to say Melchizedek is already a challenge. But I wanted to make sure we heard the passage from the verse where we have this hope as an anchor for the soul, firm and secure. I love this passage because that idea of hope as an anchor, that I'm a visual person, so it helps me understand, and we're actually going to, I couldn't go into everything an anchor does because that would have taken too long, and I'm trying to do a more basic one today as we get into things, so we'll save that for another week. But that idea that an anchor holds us in place, it keeps us from strain, it helps us stay firm during the storms. I've always loved this imagery. I think this is one of the first verses that always pops up when you look up hope. But there's a lot of misunderstandings about hope. We get this misconceptions of what we think hope is supposed to be versus what the Bible actually says hope is. And I could go on for the next few minutes telling you about it, but the Bible Project already did a much better job than I could do. So we're going to watch their video on hope.
Better than the present. You might be giddy or excited or maybe unsure, but most of us know that experience. We call it hope. It's a state of anticipation, and it's crucial for healthy human existence. And it's a really important concept in the Bible. In fact, there are many words for hope in the ancient languages of the Bible, and they're all fascinating. In the Old Testament, there are two main Hebrew words translated as hope. The first is yachal, which means simply to wait for. Like in the story of Noah and the Ark, as the floodwaters recede, Noah had to yachal for weeks. The other Hebrew word is kava, which also means to wait. It's related to the Hebrew word kav, which means cord. When you pull a kav tight, you produce a state of tension until there's release. That's kava, the feeling of tension and expectation while you wait for something to happen. The prophet Isaiah depicts God as a farmer who plants vines and kavahs for good grapes. Or the prophet Micah talks about farmers who both kavah and yachal for morning dew to give moisture to the land. So in biblical Hebrew, hope is about waiting or expectation. But waiting for what? In the period of Israel's prophets, as the nation was sinking into self-destruction, Isaiah said, "At this moment, the Lord's hiding his face from Israel, so I will kavah for him." The only hope Isaiah had in those dark days was the hope for God himself. You find the same notion of hope all over the book of Psalms, where these words appear over 40 times. In almost every case, what people are waiting for is God. Like in Psalm 130, the poet cries out from a pit of despair, "I kavah for the Lord, let Israel yachal for the Lord, because he's loyal and will redeem Israel from its sins." Biblical hope is based on a person, which makes it different from optimism. Optimism is about choosing to see, in any situation, how circumstances could work out for the best. But biblical hope is not focused on circumstances. In fact, hopeful people in the Bible often recognize there's no evidence things will get better, but you choose hope anyway. Like the prophet Hosea, he lived in a dark time when Israel was being oppressed by foreign empires, and he chose hope when he said God could turn this valley of trouble into a door of hope, like the day when Israel came up from the land of Egypt. God had surprised his people with redemption back in the days of the Exodus, and he could do so again. So it's God's past faithfulness that motivates hope for the future. You look forward by looking backward, trusting in nothing other than God's character. It's like the poet of Psalm 39 who says, "And now, O Lord, what else can I kavah for? You are my yachal." In the New Testament, the earliest followers of Jesus cultivated the similar habit of hope. They believed that Jesus' life, death, and resurrection was God's surprising response to our slavery to evil and death. The empty tomb opened up a new door of hope, and they used the Greek word elpis to describe this anticipation. The Apostle Peter said that Jesus' resurrection opened up a living hope, that people can be reborn, to become new and different kinds of humans. More than once, the Apostle Paul says, the good news about Jesus announces the elpis of glory. In both cases, this elpis is based on a person, the risen Jesus, who has overcome death. And this hope wasn't just for humans. The apostles believed that what happened to Jesus in the resurrection was a foretaste of what God had planned for the whole universe. In Paul's words, it's a hope that creation itself will be liberated from slavery to corruption into freedom when God's children are glorified. So Christian hope is bold, waiting for humanity and the whole universe to be rescued from evil and death. And some would say it's crazy, and maybe it is. But biblical hope isn't optimism based on the odds. It's a choice to wait for God to bring about a future that's as surprising as a crucified man rising from the dead. Christian hope looks back to the risen Jesus in order to look forward. And so we wait. That's what the biblical words for hope are all about.
I love that idea. Hope isn't supposed to be wishful thinking. Like, I hope it doesn't rain, or hope it does rain. It's not supposed to be, I hope I get this for Christmas, or I hope she'll or he'll go out with me. It's supposed to be this confidence, this knowing anticipation. Think about it like this. While I was sitting there, I was just thinking about this. picture Will, if you will. This is one of the worst moments when it comes to grandparents for me. We were, I don't know, Christmas, I'm guessing. That moment where my grandmother trying to interact with me, we were shooting rubber bands for some reason, and she goes, "Well, teach me how to shoot a rubber band." You can see where this is going. And of course, that tension, right? That you pull the rubber band back. Now, if you keep pulling, you know what's going to happen, right? I'm either going to let it go or it's going to snap. There is no in between. You know, you have hope that you shoot it off, or you have hope that the tension will eventually stop. For my grandmother, she let it go the wrong way, and it smacked her in the eye, and I burst out laughing as a teenager because I laugh at when people are in pain, even myself. Just, I'm equal opportunist. But I was thinking of that something has to give. That's what you know, that your hope is in this tension, knowing there's an end. You don't know when, you don't know how, but hope is confident. I love what they said, that a biblical hope isn't about looking into the future, but looking into the past. It's knowing how God has already shown up, seeing a God who is faithful and loving, and being able to see that picture that gives you hope for the future. I love that what Deuteronomy says and reminds us. It says, "Know therefore that the Lord your God is God. He is the faithful God, keeping his covenant of love to 1,000 generations of those who love him and keep his commandments." We see a God who is promising that each time he will hold us. A God who promises to not leave us. A God who promises a character that is unwavering. A God who says, "I will be with you through it all." And we see that, right? I mean, that's what all of our scriptures are about, is looking back at the Old Testament and seeing again and again how God comes through differently, in different ways, sometimes quickly, sometimes long. But a God who always comes through. I think that's the hard part for us. When we see a God in finite ways. We're bound by time and space, and so we wonder, where is God in these moments? And so I want to go back to this passage in Hebrews and look at it again and kind of give a little clarity to it. It says, "God also bound himself with an oath so that those who receive the promise could be perfectly sure that he would never change his mind. So God has given both his promise and his oath. These two things are unchangeable because it is impossible for God to lie. Therefore, we who have fled to him for refuge can have great confidence as we hold to the hope that lies before us. This hope is a strong and trustworthy anchor for our souls. It leads us through the curtain into God's inner sanctuary. Jesus has already gone in there for us. He has become our eternal high priest in the order of Melchizedek." Now, I need you to understand, there's a lot that we could unpack in Hebrews 6. We don't have time for all of that. But I do want to talk about this idea of God making a promise and giving his oath. You see, back in the days, what they would do is they say, "I swear by," and they would say something greater. And Jesus actually gets onto them because they keep swearing by these different things of what they think should be greater. And Paul uses that to talk about this idea the writers of Hebrews, says God swears by himself. This happens in Genesis when God is talking to Abraham. He's telling him, "Hey, I'm going to make you this great nation. And to make sure you understand how big of a promise this is, I promise by myself." Now, some of us might hear that and think, well, that seems kind of redundant, that doesn't make sense. But it's kind of making this, "I pinky promise." It's supposed to be this grand gesture, because what God is saying is, "I can't lie, and my character doesn't change. So what he's really saying is I'm giving you two truths in this one moment. Not only can I not lie, but I'm also saying I am unchanging. So when I promise by myself, it's going to happen. And the truth is God didn't have to say that. That's why Jesus later comes along and says, let your yes be yes and your no be no, because his answer is God just, it's always going to be yes. He's not wishy-washy. When he says, I'm going to do something, it's going to happen, which we'll come back in a minute. But you see, for us, our problem is when we hear God say he makes a promise, we hear it from human ears. And how many of you have heard someone, I promise, I pinky promise, I swear by, and have had that go badly? I think all of us could say, yeah, maybe I've made a promise. I know I've done that. I'm very careful with that word because I had a problem in high school promising everything and never following through. And so since then, I try to listen to myself not say the word promise. I try very hard not to use that word because I don't know what's going to happen. I would love to say, yes, we're going to Six Flags this weekend up until it's pouring. Or we get a flat tire. Or someone gets sick. I would love to say, I promise I'll be there for you, but I don't know what's going to happen between here and then. And that's just me with innocently trying to follow through. We understand that there are plenty of other people who say, I promise, and they never intended to. Or they promised to be faithful, and then 5 years later, changed their mind. Or as things happen, it got hard, and all of a sudden, people break the promises and the trust that we thought we had in them. And so when we hear this, we hear God say, I promise, and we go, yeah, but until when? Abraham had to wait 25 years just to get his son. And that's when God makes this promise with him. I love this. Not after the 25 years of waiting, which Abraham didn't even get that right in the waiting for him then. No, it's after 13 years later, and God has asked Abraham to sacrifice his son. This is the whole moment where we give Abraham the name of the father of faith, because he knew that I don't know how this hard moment is going to work its way out, but I know God is going to do something. Even if it means he's taking away the blessing, I'm going to trust in this moment and have hope. And it's then that God gives him a promise that I'm going to make you into a great nation, something that he will never see. He will never see how big his generations become. And the truth of what comes out of them in Jesus Christ. That's what we're saying when we say God says, I promise. It's not just this promise that we hope to see and we will. It's a hope that we have to have, knowing that it might take forever and we might not see the end. It's a hope of God, knowing that we trust God who keeps his promise day in and day out, even if we don't see how that works. That's what we mean by hope. And the problem is we put our hope in the wrong things. We put our hope in money, power, being known by everyone. We put our hope in being good enough, strong enough, smart enough. We even put our hope in religion, that we know all the answers. In our relations. How's that going for you? For some of you, it might be going really well right now. For some of you, you might realize why you need hope in God, because some of our biggest, darkest moments are because we put our hope in the wrong thing, only to find ourselves in that moment of despair. We put our hope in our retirement, our money, only to have the stock market change and come crashing down. We put our hope in our relationships only to find out they leave us after 20 years. We put our hope in our family only to find out our parents are getting a divorce. We put our hope in our education only to not get the scholarship and not get to go to the school we wanted to go to. We put our hope in our job only to be laid off. We put our hope in so many other things other than God. And find ourselves in this moment of crying out, going, what happened? And God saying, it's because you didn't trust in me. And so I remind you, we trust in God whose promises by himself. A God who doesn't lie, as Numbers says. In Numbers 23:19, God is not human that he should lie. Not a human being that he should change his mind. Does he speak and then not act? Does he promise and not fulfill? It was so powerful, I was wanting to read this. I had originally planned just to read this real quick to talk about this idea of God not lying to us. And then I realized who said this. Anyone have a guess of who said this in Numbers? My initial thoughts were, oh, okay, it's Moses, maybe Joshua, maybe it's God himself. No, it's Balaam that is saying this. Balaam, the guy, the prophet who was hired to curse Israel. This is a story going on without Israel ever knowing what is going on. God is actually in this moment, while it's being prophesied that God does not lie, he's actually fulfilling the promise that he would protect Israel no matter what. Where he told Abraham, I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. It is literally happening in this moment because this is the second time Balaam has been asked and paid to curse the Israelites. And Balaam goes, the problem is God can't lie. And so in that moment, he not only blesses the Israelites who have no idea this is going on, but also curses Balak, who is trying to have him curse them. I love that moment because here they are in the wilderness, for all we know, probably complaining again to Moses. And yet God is in the background, continuing to fulfill his promise regardless of how we are acting. That's what hope is. Hope is knowing that even if I don't know, I'm sitting in the desert, wandering around, thinking, really, I have to eat this food and only get water again, that there is a God who is protecting me from some of the worst people without me ever knowing. That's what hope is. Hope that our God is always working. A hope for Jesus Christ. As 2 Corinthians says, for Jesus Christ, the Son of God, does not waver between yes and no. He is the one whom Silas, Timothy, and I preached about, talking about Paul, to you. And as God's ultimate yes, he always does what he says. For all of God's promises have been fulfilled in Christ with a resounding yes. And through Christ, our amen, which means yes, ascends to God for his glory. It is God who enables us, along with you, to stand firm for Christ. He has commissioned us and he has identified us as his own by placing the Holy Spirit in our hearts as the first installment that guarantees everything he has promised. I love this. The God who can't break his word sends Jesus to be the ultimate yes to his promises. Jesus Christ becomes that fulfillment. Going with what Matthew said of Barabbas, he becomes that moment where a Barabbas who doesn't even know what's going on is saved because of his sin, not from anything he did, but because of Jesus Christ who came to this earth to fulfill the ultimate promises that God had made. That we don't have to despair. That we don't have to be lonely. That we don't have to always get it right. The truth is that we'll never get it right. And that's okay because we have a God who loves us. And the way he proved that was through Jesus Christ. And so I invite the praise team up as I wrap this up. It always comes back to Jesus. Jesus is the one who loved us so much that he gave his life for us. And I hope that you see that in the next few weeks as we talk about hope for our past, for our present, for our future. That you would see a God who is always moving, whether we know it or not. That has proven time and time again that we can have our hope in him. I want to end with this verse. This comes from Lamentations, and I thought it was so beautiful. The thought of my suffering and homelessness, bitter beyond words. I will never forget this awful time as I grieve over my loss. Yet I still dare to hope when I remember this. The faithful love of the Lord never ends. His mercies never cease. Great is his faithfulness. His mercies begin afresh each morning. I say to myself, the Lord is my inheritance. Therefore, I will hope in him. The Lord is good to those who depend on him, to those who search for him. So it is good to wait quietly for salvation from the Lord.